More.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. Let's start with some words by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks on the Parsha of the week, which is Parsha Emor, Book of Leviticus. He calls this Holy Times. This Parsha touches virtually every holiday in the Jewish calendar. And it's interesting how he deals with this. Here's what he says. The Parsha of Emor contains a chapter dedicated to the festivals of the Jewish year. There are five such passages in the Torah, two both in the book of Exodus 23, Exodus chapter 23, verse 14 through 17, and Exodus chapter 34, verses 18, chapter and also chapter 22 and 23. They're very brief. They refer only to the three pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. They do not specify their dates, merely their rough position in the agricultural year, nor do they mention the specific commands related to the festivals. This leaves three other festival accounts, the one in our Parsha, the second one in Book of Numbers, chapter 28 and 29, and the third in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 16. What is striking is how different they are. This is not, as some critics maintain, because the Torah is a composite document, but rather because it comes as its mindset, its subject matter from multiple perspectives, is a characteristic of the Torah mindset as a whole. The long section on the festivals in Numbers is wholly dedicated to the special additional sacrifices, that is the Musaf, brought on holy days, including Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh. A memory of this is preserved in the Musaf prayers for these days. These are holy times from the perspective of the tabernacle, the temple, later the synagogue. The account in Deuteronomy is about society. Moshe, at the end of his life, told the next generation where they had come from, where they were going, and the kind of society they were to construct. It was to be the opposite of Egypt. It would strive for justice, freedom, and human dignity. One of Deuteronomy's most important themes is its insistence that worship be centralized, quote, in the place that God will choose, which turned out to be Jerusalem. The unity of God was to be mirrored in the unity of the nation, something that could not be achieved if every tribe had its own temple, sanctuary, or shrine. That's why, when it comes to the festivals, Deuteronomy speaks only of Pesach, Shavuos, or Shavuot, and Sukkot, and not Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, because only on those three was there a duty of what's called Aliyah LeRegel, that is a pilgrimage. Aliyah is a uplifting, it's a moving ahead. LeRegel is with the legs. So the literal translation is an elevation by your legs or a pilgrimage to the temple. Equally significant is Deuteronomy's focus, not found elsewhere, on social inclusion. You, this is from the text, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, the Levites within your gates, and the stranger, the orphan, and the widow living among you. Deuteronomy is less about individual spirituality than about the kind of society that honors the presence of God by honoring our fellow humans, especially those at the margins of society. The idea that we can serve God while being indifferent to or dismissive of our fellow human beings is utterly alien to the vision of Deuteronomy. Which leaves Emor, the account in this week's Parsha. It too is distinctive. Unlike the Exodus and Deuteronomy passages, it includes Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It also tells us about the specific mitzvot of the festivals, most notably Sukkot. It is the only place where the Torah mentions the Arba Minim, the four kinds, and the command to live in a sukkah. It has, though, various structural oddities. The most striking one is the fact that it includes Shabbat in the list of the festivals. This would not be strange in itself. After all, Shabbat is one of the holy days. What is strange is the way it speaks about Shabbat or Shabbos. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, the appointed times, the Moadei, of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies. These are my appointed festivals. 6 days shall you work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of Sabbaths, a day of sacred assembly. You are not to do any work. Wherever you live, it is a Sabbath to the Lord." This is from our Parsha, Leviticus chapter 23, verse 1 through 3. Then, there is a paragraph break, after which the whole passage seems to begin again. These are the Lord's appointed times for festivals, the sacred assemblies. You are to proclaim at their appointed times. And this is Leviticus chapter 23, verse 4. So it does sound like they're just repeating themselves. This structure, with its two beginnings, puzzled the commentators. Even more puzzling was the fact that the Torah here seems to be calling Shabbos a moed, an appointed time, and a mikra kodesh, a sacred assembly, which it does nowhere else. As Rashi puts it, what has the Sabbath to do with the festivals? The festivals are annual occurrences. Shabbat is a weekly one. The festivals depend on the calendar fixed by the Beit Din. That's the meaning of the phrase, the sacred assemblies you are to proclaim at their appointed times. The Sabbath, however, does not depend on any act by the Beit Din and is independent of both the solar and the lunar calendar. Its holiness comes directly from God and from the dawn of creation. Bringing the two together under a single heading seems to make no sense. The Sabbath is one thing. Moadim and Mikre Ekodesh are something else. What connects the two? Rashi tells us this text seeks to emphasize the holiness of the festivals. Whoever desecrates the festivals, it is as if he had desecrated the Sabbath. And whoever observes the festivals, it is as if he had observed the Sabbath. The point Rashi is making is that we can imagine someone saying that they respect the Sabbath because it is God-given, but the festivals are an altogether lesser sanctity. First, because we are permitted certain kinds of work, such as cooking and carrying, and second, because they depend on a human act of fixing the calendar. The inclusion of the Sabbath among the festivals is to negate this kind of reasoning. Well, Rambam offers a very different explanation. Shabbat is stated before the festivals just as it is stated before Moshe's instructions to the people to begin work on the construction of the sanctuary, to tell us that just as the command to build the sanctuary does not override the Sabbath, so too the command to celebrate the festivals does not override the Sabbath. So, although we may cook and carry on the festivals, we may not do so if a festival falls on the Sabbath. By far, the most radical explanation was given by the Vilna Gaon. According to him, the words, 6 days shall you work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of Sabbaths, do not apply to the days of the week, but to the days of the year. There are 7 holy days specified in our Parsha, the first and seventh day of Passover, 1 day of Shavuot, 1 day of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the first day of Sukkot, and Shemini Atzeret. On 6 of them we are allowed to do some work, such as cooking and carrying, but on the 7th, Yom Kippur, we are not, because it is a Sabbath of Sabbaths. The Torah uses 2 different expressions for the prohibition of work on festivals in general and on the seventh day. On the festivals, what is forbidden is called Melechet Avoda, burdensome or servile work, whereas on the seventh day, what is forbidden is Malacha, any work, even if not burdensome. So, Yom Kippur is to the year what Shabbat is to the week. The Vilna Gaon's reading allows us to see something else. That holy time is patterned on what I've called, in the introduction to the Siddur, fractals, the same pattern at different levels of magnitude. So the structure of the week, 6 days of work followed by a seventh day that is holy, is mirrored in the structure of the year. 6 days of lesser holiness plus the seventh, Yom Kippur, of supreme holiness. As we will see in a couple of chapters' time, when we get to Leviticus chapter 25, the same pattern appears on an even larger scale. 6 ordinary years followed by the year of Shemitah, or release. Wherever the Torah wishes to emphasize the dimension of holiness, the word Kodesh appears no less than 12 times in Leviticus chapter 23. It makes systematic use of the number and concept of 7. So there are not only 7 holy days in the annual calendar, there are also 7 paragraphs in the chapter. The word 7 or seventh occurs repeatedly, 18 times, as does the word for the seventh day, Shabbos, in one or more of its forms, 15 times. The word harvest appears 7 times. However, it seems to me that Leviticus chapter 3 is telling another story as well, a deeply spiritual one. Recall our argument, made by Judah HaLevi and Ibn Ezra, that almost the entire 40 chapters between Exodus 24 and Leviticus 25 are a digression, brought about because Moshe argued that the people needed God to be close. They wanted to encounter him not only at the top of the mountain, but also in the midst of the camp. Not only as a terrifying power overturning empires and dividing the sea, but also as a constant presence in their lives. That was why God gave the Israelites the sanctuary and its service. That's why the list of the festivals in Leviticus emphasizes not the social dimension we find in Deuteronomy or the sacrificial dimension we find in Numbers, but rather the spiritual dimension of encounter, closeness, the meeting of the human and the divine. This explains why we find in this chapter more than in any other 2 key words. One is Moed, the other is Mikra Kodesh. Both are deeper than they seem. The word Moed does not just mean appointed time. We find the same word in the phrase Ohel Moed, meaning tent of meeting. If the Ohel Moed was the place where man and God met, then the Moedim in our chapter are the times when we and God meet. This idea is given beautiful expression in the last line of the mystical song we sing on the Sabbath, Yadid Nefesh, Hurry, beloved, for the appointed time, the Moed, has come. Moed here means a tryst, an appointment made between lovers to meet at a certain time and place. As for the phrase Mikra Kodesh, it comes from the same root as the word that gives the entire book its name, Vayikra, meaning to be summoned in love. A Mikra Kodesh is not just a holy day. It's a meeting to which we have been called in affection by one who holds us close. That is, the one who holds us close. Much of the book of Vayikra is about the holiness of place, the sanctuary. Some of it is about the holiness of people, the Kohanim, the priests, and Israel as a whole, as a kingdom of priests. In chapter 23, the Torah turns to the holiness of time and the times of holiness. We are spiritual beings, but we are also physical beings. We cannot be spiritual, close to God, all the time. That is why there is secular time as well as holy time. But one day in seven, we stop working and enter the presence of the God of creation. On certain days of the year, the festivals, we celebrate the God of history. The holiness of the Sabbath is determined by God alone, because God alone created the universe. The holiness of the festivals is partially determined by us, that is, the fixing of the calendar, because history is a partnership between us and God. But in two respects, they are the same. They are both times of meeting, Moed, and they are both times when we feel ourselves called, summoned, invited as God's guests. That's the Mikra Kodesh. We can't always be spiritual. God has given us a material world in which to engage. But on the seventh day of the week, and originally 7 days in the year, God gives us dedicated time in which we feel the closeness of the Shekhinah and are bathed in the radiance of God's love. Interesting commentary on this week's Parsha Emor. It's amazing the content that people can understand by studying the text. Rabbi Sacks in particular, I would say, because he's able to communicate the subtleties that he finds and the concepts that he finds, the holiness that he finds as he reads and studies the chapters. So this one on Parsha Emor, the Parsha of the week, this week, by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. Well, I want to move on to some other holidays, if you will. At this time of year, behind us a week or two, actually beginning almost with Passover, which was almost a month ago, several holidays are observed, and, you know, particularly at the end of April and the beginning of May. Yom HaShoah, which is remembering the Holocaust. Yom HaZikaron, which is a memorial day in Israel for, once again, the martyrs who fell in the Holocaust, and also those who fell in defense of the state of Israel. And also we have Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and that's a holiday about, it's Israeli Independence Day, celebrating Israeli independence, which of course wouldn't be happening if we didn't have these other days. Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. So I want to talk about these holidays a little bit, read a couple articles that I hope you find interesting. Once again, these are all articles by Rabbi Sacks. And here's what he has to say. We'll begin with one here called A Call to Remember from the Depths of Our Jewish Soul. Now, all the holidays commemorating in some way the tragedy of the Shoah, the remembrance of our holy martyrs, and the commemoration of Israel Independence Day, which marks the redemption of the Jews in the modern age, they occur almost on top of each other at this time of year. We're barely finished with Pesach, which marks the beginning of the Jewish people's trek through history, when we come face to face with the Holocaust, intended to end our existence, our trek through history entirely. Well, during the nightmare years of the Shoah, one moment stands out for what it taught about the human spirit. It concerns a man almost unknown in Britain, the Polish-Jewish physician Janusz, sometimes Janusz, Korczak. Early on in his medical career, Korczak was drawn to the plight of underprivileged children. He wrote books about their neglect and became a kind of a Polish Dickens. In 1911, he founded an orphanage for Jewish children in Warsaw. It became so successful that he was asked to create one for Catholic children as well, which he did. He had his own radio program, which made him famous throughout Poland. He was known across the country as the Old Doctor, but he had revolutionary views about the young. He believed in trusting them and giving them responsibility. He got them to produce their own newspaper, the first children's paper in Poland. He turned schools into self-governing communities. He wrote some of the great works of child psychology, including one called The Child's Right to Respect. He believed that in each child there burned a moral flame that, if nurtured, could defeat the darkness which is at the core of human nature. When the time came for the children under his care to leave, he used to say this to them, "I cannot give you love of man, for there is no love without forgiveness, and forgiving is something everyone must learn to do on his own. I can give you one thing only, a longing for a better life, a life of truth and justice. Even though it may not exist now, it may come tomorrow if you long for it enough." In 1940, he and the orphanage were driven to the Warsaw Ghetto. In 1942, the order came to transport them to Treblinka. Korczak was offered the chance to escape, but he refused. And in one of the most poignant moments of those years, he walked with his 200 orphans through the streets of Warsaw to the train that took them to the gates of death, inseparable from them to the end. Janusz Korczak's actions were not unique, though there are many inspirational and tragic stories of similar bravery and determination in the face of such adversity. What draws me to Korczak's story is that it was about children. The Nazis were determined not just to wipe out the Jews of their generations, but to exterminate the Jewish future as well. They failed. And many of those children who survived have spent the years since telling their stories, educating Jews and non-Jews about the dangers of intolerance and the need to respect the dignity of difference. These survivors made a commitment to live for what the victims of the Shoah died for. As a people, we not only share a covenant of faith, we also share a covenant of fate. Today, as the number of Shoah survivors sadly declines, the duty of remembrance falls onto our generation and on future generations not yet born. That's why I commend the Jewish News and the Forum for Yom HaShoah UK for working in partnership to raise the profile of Holocaust remembrance within Anglo-Jewry. Yom HaShoah is a vital day in the Jewish calendar, providing us with a focal point for our remembrance. We cannot bring the dead back to life, but we can bring their memory back to life and ensure they are not forgotten. We can undertake in our lives to do what they were so cruelly prevented from doing in their lives. In doing so, we make a great affirmation of life. We ensure that out of the darkest night, the light of the survivors and their memories remain. Faced with destruction, the Jewish people survived. Lo amut ki echeye, says the psalm. I will not die, but I will live. The Shoah survivors are among the most inspiring people I've had the privilege to meet. Remarkably, despite coming eyeball to eyeball with the angel of death, despite the unimaginable losses each of them suffered, so many of them fulfilled the words of Moshe's great command, Uvacharta b'chayim, choose life. In doing so, they chose life not just for themselves, but for their children, their grandchildren, and all future generations of Am Yisrael. Yom HaShoah calls on us to remember from the depths of our Jewish soul. Janos Korczak was right. While we can remember the past, we cannot write the future. Only our children, the future of our community, can do that. One more here. This one titled Moral Voice. And Rabbi Sacks argues that anti-Semitism matters because it's an assault on humanity. When he wrote this a few years ago, Yom HaShoah was on the same date as an uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. It was a remarkable event and one of the more significant ones in Jewish history. It marked the beginning of the IDF, and that became the Israeli Defense Forces, the Israeli Army. The Nazis deliberately timed some of their worst programs of mass murder to take place on Jewish festivals as a way of killing not only Jews, but also Jewish faith. So they planned to liquidate the ghetto and murder all its inhabitants on Passover 1943. To prove somehow on the Jewish festival of freedom that the God of freedom did not exist. Somehow, Jews within the ghetto heard about this in advance. And though they were weakened by starvation and disease and had only a handful of weapons, they determined on a collective act of defiance. They knew that since they were surrounded by the German army, that they could not win. But they held out for more than a month, and sporadic fighting continued for another 3 weeks. It was a turning point in Jewish history. And a ragtag fighting force though it was, it held out longer than the nation of Poland when it was attacked by Germany in 1939. Great rabbis in the ghetto supported the uprising. They said, this persecution is different from any other in Jewish history. In the past, Jews were persecuted by people who wanted them to convert. So Jews were willing to go to their deaths as martyrs rather than to betray their faith. But the Nazis did not want Jews to convert. They wanted them to die. So, said the rabbis, we must defy them by refusing to die, by fighting for the right to live. They knew that almost all of them would die anyway, but they wanted to make a protest in the name of life, and they did so with immense courage. After the Holocaust, Jews and much of the world vowed, never again. Yet, in the last few years, anti-Semitism has returned to Europe, from Greece to the south, to Norway in the north, from France in the west, to Russia in the east. Nothing like what it was in the past, still enough to make Jews fear what the future may bring. Anti-Semitism matters, not because it is an assault on Jews, but because it's an assault on humanity. Jews were hated because they were a minority, because they were different. But we're all different, and any group may one day find itself a minority. It wasn't just the Jews alone who suffered under Hitler, which is why we must learn to fight hate together. We owe the heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto no less, And once again, we owe ourselves no less. Here's one more. This is Rabbi Sacks' reflections on his first, and I believe his only visit to Auschwitz, which was done in September of 1995. He was impressed with a photo that he saw. It was a photo of a collection of shoes. There were more than a million shoes found at Auschwitz, each one of them from a person. It's a very sobering photo. If you can just imagine a pile of shoes, you can see the ones that match, from adult shoes to baby shoes, just shoes. And a million shoes is a lot, believe me. It almost is an endless photo. Here's what he says. Until now, I have never been to Auschwitz. For me, it's been the black hole of Jewish history, an echoing abyss which I never wanted to enter. But listening to the nightmare stories of the survivors, I realized there was something they wanted from us, the generation born after the Holocaust. They wanted us not to forget. But what is it to remember life in the midst of death? I don't know. And that's why I've come here, to see and listen and reflect. Old men and women, children in their hundreds of thousands, Jews from across Europe, rabbis, musicians, professors, husbands, wives, ordinary people whose sole crime was that they had a Jewish grandparent. That's all it took, one Jewish grandparent. They came packed in cattle trucks. Many of them died on the journey. They brought their luggage with them because they'd been told they were just going to be resettled. And then they came to the gate with the words, Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free. By then, some must have realized that Auschwitz was built on lies, and these were the gates of the kingdom of death. Walking through Auschwitz, what strikes one today is how carefully the Nazis were to waste nothing. They took everything, kept everything, and not only items of value. Here you see mountains of suitcases, piles of toothbrushes, and shoes. Hundreds of thousands of shoes, worn, battered, but still collected. Nothing was too valueless to throw away, except life. A million shoes saved, a million lives destroyed. For 3,000 years, Jews lived by a set of values first proclaimed in the Hebrew Bible, the sanctity of life, the moral covenant between man and God, the idea that authority is conferred by right, not might, the love we owe the stranger, the dignity of every human being as created in the image of God. It was those values that Hitler despised. He once called conscience a Jewish invention. But when they are lost, this is the world created in their place. Here, might ruled over right. The stranger was hated. The covenant defaced, and the image of God burned and turned to ash. It was the nightmare kingdom where man sent God into exile and condemned his witnesses to the gas chambers. The Nazis were not content to kill Jews. They wanted to murder the Jewish faith itself. They cut the beards from rabbis' faces. They shot Jews who prayed. And they deliberately chose the Jewish holy days for their worst acts of brutality. Here at Auschwitz, the worst selections for the crematoria took place on Yom Kippur. Dr. Joseph Mengele used to tell Jewish prisoners, "Here I rule in place of God. I decide who will live and who will die." On Yom Kippur, we believe God writes us in the Book of Life. Auschwitz was the book written by man, and it was a book of death. People sometimes ask me, where was God at Auschwitz? I don't know, but Jewishly, it's the wrong question. The real question, perhaps the better question, where was humanity at Auschwitz? God never said that he'd stop us harming one another, but he did give us a moral code, commandments engraved in stone, which taught us how to stop ourselves. Where was humanity when old men and women were being murdered, millions being gassed, children thrown on the flames while still alive? The real question, so painful we can hardly ask it, is not where was God when we called to him, but where were we when he called to us? I don't understand what it was to live here. I don't understand what it was to die here. I don't understand what it was to issue the orders, to carry the orders out, to decide who would live and who would die. But I think I understand one thing, that this is what the Bible warned us against in its very first chapter, when God said, "Let us make man in our own image, after our own likeness." When human life is no longer sacred, Auschwitz becomes possible. And standing here, I hear those other words from the book of Genesis, God's words to Cain, "The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." What prayer do you say here on this desecrated ground? Shalom Katz was one of those who stood here. He and 50 other prisoners were ordered to dig their own grave and then stand in front of it to be shot. Before the guns were raised, he asked the guards permission to say the Jewish prayer for the dead. It was granted, and he sang it. And the guards were so moved by the beauty of his voice that they took him out of the line. They kept him alive to sing for them. And he was still here at Auschwitz when Auschwitz was liberated. Then he sang the prayer a second time for all those who had died. O God, full of compassion, grant rest to those who have gone from this world and shelter their souls under the wings of your presence. I came to Auschwitz to honor the memory of those who died, among them members of my own family, great aunts and uncles from Poland and Lithuania. But now that I've come, I feel overwhelmed by a sense of evil so vast it leaves you numb. Here, where 1.5 million died, where those who lived were robbed of all humanity, where you're surrounded by factories whose product was death, you feel a chill like ice. I've come, and I don't know that I'll ever want to be here again. The sense of desolation is still too great. There is nothing here but a massive echoing silence that swallows words and robs them of their meaning. And yet, I now know that we must never forget the Holocaust. Never again may we walk down the road that begins with hate and ends in attempted genocide. Towards the end of his life, Moses summoned the Israelites and said, "I've set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore, choose life." That choice still stands before us with its two monumental symbols, Auschwitz and Yom Kippur, the book of death or the book of life. And this too, I know now, that some extraordinary reserve of spirit has renewed itself. Jews didn't despair. The survivors built new lives. New communities grew up elsewhere. And in the state of Israel, we've come together as a people again, building one of the world's oldest and newest countries, and singing Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people lives. For me, faith after Auschwitz is the courage to live and bring new life into the world, never forgetting those who died, but never yielding to despair. It means fighting for a world in which we recognize that those who aren't in our image are still in God's image. It means remembering for the sake of life and humanity and hope. Wherever I travel throughout the Jewish world, in Israel as it strives to create peace And throughout the diaspora, as Jews marry and build Jewish homes and light the candle of faith in a new generation, I witness something I can only call the Shekhinah, the name we give to God as he enters the human heart and gives it a strength we didn't know we had. And on the faces of Jewish children, I see a people who walk through the valley of the shadow of death, coming to life again, cherishing life, sanctifying it, and knowing that in it is the breath of God. Well, those are Yonatan Sacks' thoughts, recollections from his visit to Auschwitz, 1967. One more. Why we all need a Holocaust Memorial Day. This article was first published by the Daily Telegraph in January of 2015. Well, once again, he notes that on Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day, was also the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz when he wrote this. He says, this year, besides remembering the obvious, we'll also remember the 12 people killed in the attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris, the murdered policewoman, and the four customers in a Jewish supermarket shot as they were shopping on the eve of the Sabbath. The journalists and the policewoman were killed because of what they did, satirizing the Prophet Muhammad and guarding the public. The Jewish customers were killed because of what they were. They were Jews. 70 years after the Holocaust, anti-Semitism is alive and well and is growing in Europe. Do we need Holocaust Memorial Day? That was the question Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister, asked leaders of British Jewry in 1999. It had been proposed that we have one for the UK, and he wanted our opinion. We explained that we did not need it as Jews. We already have Yom HaShoah, our own Memorial Day, which falls soon after Passover on the Jewish calendar. Every Jew, literally or figuratively, lost family in the Holocaust. For us, Yom HaShoah is grief observed. But yes, we said, for the Holocaust was not just a crime against Jews and other victims, Roma, Sinti, homosexuals, handicapped, Jehovah's Witnesses among them. The Holocaust was an assault on humanity. Primo Levi, when he wrote his Auschwitz memoir, did not call it, "If this is a Jew." He called it, "If this is a man." Jews were hated because they were different. The classic statement is Haman's remark to King Ahasuerus in the Book of Esther, that there is a people scattered among the nations, quote, who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people. That's the Book of Esther, chapter 3, verse 8. Anti-Semitism is the paradigm case of dislike of the unlike. For 1,000 years, Jews were the archetypical other, non-Christians in Christian Europe, non-Muslims in a Muslim Middle East. But we are all other. We are all different, all unique. That is what makes us human. A society that has no room for difference has no room for humanity. The hate that begins with Jews never ends with Jews. Wherever you find anti-Semitism, there you also find a threat to liberty. No free society was ever built on hate. Today, anti-Semitism is rife in the Arab and Muslim world. Jews have been accused of almost everything: controlling America, dominating Europe, manipulating the economy, running the media, perpetrating 9/11, and all subsequent terrorist attacks, creating AIDS, Ebola, the 2004 tsunami, and, of course, climate change, global warming. Four different myths have been created about the Holocaust. The Iranian version is that it didn't happen. It was invented by Jews to further the aims of Zionism. Another is that it half happened, and the pity is that Hitler did not finish the job. The third is that it happened, and the Jews deserved it. The fourth is that it happened, but now Jews are the new Nazis, and the poor Palestinians, of course, the new Jews. This matters greatly, because anti-Semitism is only incidentally about Jews. It is fundamentally about a certain kind of cognitive dissonance within the cultures that give rise to it. It happens when their own self-image is contradicted by the world outside. Judeophobia was born around the year 95, when the Gospel of John called Jews children of the devil. It did not become murderous for 1,000 years, until 1096, when crusaders on their way to liberate the Holy Land stopped to massacre the Jewish community of Worms, Mainz, and Cologne. This is all in Germany, initiating centuries of Christian persecution of the Jews. That was when Christians woke up to the fact that they had been overtaken by Islam. Nazi anti-Semitism started after Germany's defeat in the First World War and the humiliating terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Muslim anti-Semitism, as opposed to the negative statements about Jews in the Quran and the Hadith, began in 1924, when the Ottoman Empire fell. 4 years later, the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamism were born. Anti-Semitism makes cognitive dissonance bearable by turning the question, why has this happened, into another question, who did this to me? If it is someone else's fault, not mine, I can preserve my self-respect. I become the victim, not the perpetrator. Crimes against humanity then become holy deeds, done to avenge my people or my faith. That is what turns ordinary human beings into crusaders in one age, Nazis in another, and suicide bombers and terrorists in a third. As long as students are taught at madrasas, those are Muslim schools, that Jews are the enemy of mankind, extremists will be condemning Islam, a noble faith, to self-inflicted injury for generations to come. To be free, you have to let go of hate. There is no other way. Okay, we have time, I think, for one more. I'll read quickly, see if we can get through this. This, of course, is about the coronation of the latest king, King Charles, in Great Britain. And his connection and Britain's connection to Jews in his 7 historical tidbits in this article. So let's start with noting that her son Charles immediately became king after Queen Elizabeth's death. And he and his wife, who is now Queen Camilla, will be formally crowned at Westminster Abbey, and that will happen today as I'm speaking to you. He's the 40th monarch crowned in Westminster Abbey in a line that stretches back 900 years to William the Conqueror's coronation, Christmas Day, 1066. And Britain will do what it arguably does best, put on a diamond-drenched, ermine-laden, gold-hued royal show, topped with all the pageantry, ceremony, pomp and circumstance, and ancient traditions it can muster. It is a Christian service, largely unchanged for the past 1,000 years, in which the king will take the oath, be anointed, blessed, and consecrated, and have St. Edward's crown, made for King Charles II in 1661, placed on his head. But there's also Jewish details, such as Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mirvis participating in the ceremony at Westminster Abbey on the Sabbath morning, a Jewish tailoring firm providing uniforms, 3 Jewish composers penning new music in the king's honor, befitting the community's close and comfortable relationship with the royal family. Well, here's some historical ties, not all of them rosy, that link the kingdom's Jewish subjects to its monarchy. Okay, Charles in Israel. While his mother, the late Queen Elizabeth II, never visited Israel, the monarch's overseas visits all take place with the advice and consent of the government. Charles paid his first ever official visit to Israel in 2020. It wasn't his first visit to Israel. He had made private ones before to attend the funerals of Yitzhak Rabin and also Shimon Peres. However, it was the new heir to the throne, Charles' eldest son, William, who blazed the royal trail to Israel. In 2018, William, who now had the title of Prince of Wales, paid the first ever official visit to Israel by a member of the royal family. Okay, number two, it was fitting Charles' first official visit to Israel was to attend the World Holocaust Forum. The King, Charles, has been a long-standing vocal opponent of anti-Semitism and has involved himself in Holocaust commemoration and education and as an active patron of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. He took that role over from the late Queen in 2016. In January, Charles issued his first message since becoming king on his mother's death, marking the UK's annual Holocaust Memorial Day. And he spoke about his many meetings with Holocaust survivors. One of them was 98-year-old Lily Ebert. And when he met her, she told him, "Meeting you, it is for everyone who lost their lives." Charles touched her shoulder and replied, "But it is a greater privilege for me." Number three, Charles' interest in the Holocaust is personal. In 1993, his grandmother, Princess Alice of Battenberg, was awarded the title Righteous Among the Nations by Yad Vashem. Alice, the mother of Charles' father, the late Duke of Edinburgh, was a member of the royal Greek family who was living in Athens when the Nazis occupied the city in World War II. Alice subsequently sheltered Rachel Cohen, widow of Haimaki Cohen, a former member of parliament and ally of the royal family, and two of her children at her royal residence. According to Yad Vashem, there were times when the Germans became suspicious, and Princess Alice was even interviewed by the Gestapo. Using her deafness, she pretended not to understand their questions until they left her alone. She saved the whole family, Cohen's granddaughter later said. "Clearly, I wouldn't be alive. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be born if not for her." Number four, I thought this one was interesting. This is oil from the Holy Land. The anointing oil, or chrism, that will be used during the coronation ceremony has traveled from afar. Created from olives harvested from two groves on the Mount of Olives, it was consecrated in a ceremony at Jerusalem's Church of the Holy Sepulchre in March, conducted by the Patriarch of Jerusalem, His Beatitude, Patriarch Theophilos III, and the Anglican Archbishop in Jerusalem, the Most Reverend Hossam Naum. The oils were pressed just outside Bethlehem. The oil has been perfumed with essential oils, sesame, rose, jasmine, cinnamon, neroli, benzoin, and amber, as well as orange blossom. The palace added that the formula has been used for hundreds of years, a point emphasized at the time of the consecration ceremony by Welby. This demonstrates the deep historic link between the coronation, the Bible, and the Holy Land, the Archbishop said. From ancient kings down to the present day, monarchs have been anointed with oil from this sacred place. Well, let's see. Let's try just a little more here. The relationship between Britain's Jews and the monarchy has not always been harmonious or without incident. There was a pogrom at the coronation of Richard I in 1189. Jewish leaders attempting to bring gifts to the new monarch were attacked. An orgy of violence followed, which saw Jews fleeing to the Tower of London to seek shelter. The 12th century chronicler and diplomat Roger Howden recorded that only those Jews who hid in the royal citadel or in the homes of friends escaped death. The crusade fever of the late 1180s was likely the driving factor in the massacres, combining with the already present anti-Jewish prejudice, economic resentment, and opposition to the crown's relationship with the Jews, according to historian Dr. Rory McClellan. And finally, a royal expulsion and a republican return. Legally, Jews in medieval England were viewed as the property of the crown. Seen as a valuable cash cow, royal officials cynically charged with protecting Jews from the mob, while also ensuring they paid up with arbitrary taxes when and as the king needed them. This relationship came to a close in 1290 when King Edward I signed the Edict of Expulsion. Financially drained by exploitative taxation, the community's ability to contribute to the monarch's coffers had been severely limited. Edward thus ordered all Jews in England out, some 3,000 in all, either convert or go into exile. And Jews did not return to England until the 1650s, when they were invited to resettle by a parliamentary leader, Oliver Cromwell, during England's brief flirtation with republicanism. Well, that's what I have for you today, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you for joining me for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community and remind you my name is Michael Wolin. And I'd like to invite you also to stay tuned for our next program. Finally, I'd like to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavuot Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.